Good morning and welcome to MTSU On the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Tennessee's New Abolitionist is a new book, a compilation of historical essays, if you will, about the history of opposition to the death penalty in the state of Tennessee, co-edited by Dr. Amy Seward, who is the chair of the Department of History here at MTSU, and Dr. Margaret Vandiver, who is a professor in the Department of Criminal Justice and Criminology at the University of Memphis. Amy is here with us today to talk about the book, as is Reverend Stacy Rector, who is executive director of Tennesseans for Alternatives to the Death Penalty and a contributor to Tennessee's New Abolitionist. Thank you all for being with us here today.
Thanks for having us, Jenna.
Amy, I'm going to start out with a childhood memory, just to make it personal. When I was growing up, Buford Ellington was the first governor I remember in Tennessee in my lifetime, but I would hear tales about Frank Clement when he was governor. We're talking about former Congressman Bob Clement's daddy going down to the jails and talking to the prisoners, because Governor Clement was anti-death penalty. Talk a little bit about how anti-death penalty sentiment has managed to survive and express itself in a state that didn't always welcome that sentiment.
Well, it's really interesting. It actually is what prompted me to write the book, is when you look at the literature about the death penalty, they'll talk about how it's very much a Southern phenomenon, particularly since 1976. Something like 85% of all the executions happening in the United States have happened in the South. And then they'll go on and say that's tied to history of race in the South. It's tied to a culture of honor and violence. It is tied to all sorts of things, fundamentalist religion. And I looked at that and I said, well, Tennessee is part of the South. It has those elements in its culture, but it had a very different history with the death penalty. One of the oddest things, 1803, John Sevier recommended abolition of the death penalty in Tennessee. Now, no one in the country was talking about abolition of the death. You know, he suggested that Tennessee maybe didn't need a death penalty.
I would wager most people who live in Sevierville today don't know that.
Probably not. And then in the 19-teens, Tennessee became the only state in the South to ever legislatively abolish the death penalty for murder. You know, and then we have Governor Clement in the 50s who, and he's a very interesting case because, of course, you know, he was governor on and off for a number of terms. He came to his abolitionist views gradually. He was not initially opposed to the death penalty, but that process of meeting and talking to the people on death row, of talking to their families, changed his view. One of the famous stories, he actually took his friend Billy Graham to visit those men on death row as well. And so in his last term as governor, he decided, you know, we really don't need the death penalty in Tennessee. And he came two votes shy of having it abolished by the legislature. When that failed, he commuted the sentences from death to life in prison for the folks who were facing execution at that point. And then again, 1976, the Supreme Court brings back the death penalty, and Governor Blanton vetoes it. The legislature passes it by huge majorities, and he vetoes it. Now, of course, in Tennessee, vetoing the death penalty doesn't actually do anything because you only need a simple majority to override a governor's veto. But it was very interesting to me that he invested that political capital to veto something that was obviously popular with the people of Tennessee.
We're not talking about a governor who, right before he goes out the door, and who, because he knows he's not running for re-election, such as the case with the governor of Illinois, saying, all right, full and free pardon, and he doesn't have to pay the political price for it. He gets to do the right thing on his way out. This was totally different.
Well, and Blanton even ran on, you know, made public when he was running for governor that he opposed the death penalty and was elected. Obviously, he didn't have the best history after that.
Right.
But so I was really interested, you know, why is Tennessee's history seem to be so ambivalent? when it comes to the death penalty, when most other southern states don't seem to have nearly as much ambivalence. So that was the question that prompted this book at the beginning.
And after you collected all of your efforts from all of your various authors, did you come to any overriding conclusion, or is it still an open issue for you?
Well, of course, in history, you can't ever solve anything definitively.
Right.
But what I ended up really seeing is Tennessee, especially since the Civil War, has seen itself as the vanguard of the New South, as being a progressive state, and the city of Nashville being a progressive city, the Athens of the South, a focus on education. And that was meant to serve some political purposes, in part to attract foreign investment. And when you look at the governors who had the most ambivalent or negative feelings for the death penalty, they were also some of the more progressive governors in terms of promoting new institutions. Governor Clement, really well known for the state mental institutions that he established that provided, you know, some of the best care in the nation at that point to folks suffering from mental illness. Governor Blanton signed the first child safety seat law ever in the world into law. And both of those governors also were working very hard to attract investment from the northern United States, and Blanton particularly from Europe. And Europe, which has abolished the death penalty, tends to look at those southern states a little askance and worries about investing in states that have the death penalty. So I saw that, you know, effort to promote Tennessee as a progressive new South state as playing an important political role, particularly for those governors. And where some folks would say that the religion in the South promotes the death penalty, it also very much cut the other way. When I started looking at the folks who started the modern abolitionist movement in Tennessee, Will Campbell, Southern Baptist minister, and then the folks who worked with him initially with the Committee of Southern Churchmen, Southern Coalition on Jails and Prisons, and Southern Prison Ministry, they all came. They were all native Southerners who were all ordained or in divinity school and saw this as part of their religious mission.
And I would think the African American church, since there's a disproportionate number of African Americans on death row, would be right in with this movement. Or did you find that there was some dissension within the black community about that?
Historically, there certainly was not. One of the most eloquent folks arguing against reinstatement of the death penalty in the Senate in 1976 was Avon Williams. Of course, you know, very prominent civil rights leader. And when you look particularly at that reinstatement debate in 1976, the black community very much was opposed to bringing the death penalty back. And politically, they had the black caucus in Tennessee, which Stacy can talk about, has been a big supporter of a lot of initiatives regarding the death penalty.
Stacy, as someone who is highly active in the effort to abolish the death penalty, how do you like the analogy that Amy is drawing with her title, Tennessee's New Abolitionist? How do you like being, in essence, compared to the people who were vehemently against slavery in the 19th century in this country? Does it resonate with you?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I think it's exciting to me to be a part of something that I believe has been a long time coming, but that will come as more and more Tennesseans and more people in this country generally become educated about this issue and understand all the variety of reasons why this system simply isn't working. I'm one of those people, as Amy referenced, who really got at this issue initially because of my faith, being an ordained Presbyterian minister, looking at it theologically, looking at it as a justice issue, a social justice issue. But as I've learned about it, and as I have conversations with people across the state, what I've become more and more aware of is that regardless of people's moral stance on this issue, when they are given the way this system is working in practice, or as I would say, not working in practice, the fact that it's so exorbitantly expensive, far more expensive than the alternatives of life without the possibility of parole, when they find out that it's mainly the poor who are affected by this system because they don't get adequate legal counsel. And when they find out that more and more members of law enforcement are saying, this is not the most effective way to prevent violent crime, and we're spending resources that we could be spending on mental health care and drug treatment and education, you know, we're spending that on this system that's really not accomplishing anything. And as more and more murder victims' family members are coming out and saying this is not serving the true needs of murder victims' family members. So as I'm having those conversations, I'm seeing that there's so many reasons that people are beginning to pay more attention. And obviously this year with the state budget being in the situation that it's in, I've really felt that more and more legislators across the board, across the political spectrum, are beginning to look at this in a different way, regardless of whether they come at it again that it's right or wrong or appropriate or inappropriate to have this penalty. Is it effective? Is it serving the needs of the people of Tennessee? And I think the resounding answer to that question, if you look at it, is absolutely not.
How prevalent is the old stigma or the old canard that you and like-minded people are just a bunch of wild-eyed leftist or idealistic dreamers? Is that abating to any degree?
It is abating. It's still very much out there. It's part of the reason our organization recently did change the name of our organization to Tennesseans for Alternatives to the Death Penalty, because we believe in accountability. We believe that people who commit violent crime must be held accountable for those actions. We believe that there are alternatives. We don't promote any of those particular alternatives, but we know that they exist. There are alternatives that are less expensive, that can protect society, that can hold people accountable, but they can do so without the use of the death penalty. And one of the biggest things that we're beginning to learn and talk more about is the question of innocence and the fact that in an imperfect system, no matter how well-intentioned, mistakes are made. And when you have that kind of risk of executing an innocent individual, why continue with this policy when you have these alternatives that have been shown to be just as effective and less expensive for the state?
The scientific advance of DNA analysis must be a boon to you and in your efforts.
It's absolutely been. Also, more studies that have been done on things like eyewitness identification and the fact that those can be very, very questionable sometimes because of the human mind and memory and trauma and all those kind of things. So there's all sorts of advancements that have been made in and around this issue as far as the science and understanding how people react and function within this kind of a situation. And, you know, we just know that at the end of the day, mistakes get made. Yeah. It's just the reality. And why take a risk when you don't have to? And in Tennessee, we have had in this state now 6 executions in the modern era of the death penalty. As Amy named, our state was reluctant to begin the use of the death penalty. We didn't execute anybody here until the year 2000 after the death penalty's reinstatement in the 70s. Since that time, we've executed 6 people and released 2 people who spent more than 20 years each fighting their convictions, both of whom had DNA in their cases.
Did they receive any sort of compensation, monetary compensation?
None. That is a continual process for them as they're trying to determine what possibly could be some reparation for spending 20 plus years of your life on death row for something you didn't do.
Yeah. Amy, when you look at the history of the abolition, death penalty abolition movement in Tennessee, when you talk about this ambivalence, it makes me wonder if early anti-death penalty activists in the state had to worry about blowback as a result of their activism, either in terms of social stigma or literally violent threats against them or their families, or did they feel relatively free to be able to express themselves over time?
They actually felt very free to express themselves. Duke Bowers was a Memphis grocery store magnate. He led sort of a single-man campaign that led to the abolition for a short period of time of the death penalty there in the teens. He was very positive, very well received by legislators.
A liberal Cas Walker.
Well, and there were a number of candidates. There was a state legislator from Memphis named Louis Taliaferro, who's in the book. He was elected specifically on, if you send me to Nashville, I will abolish the death penalty platform. It's hard to imagine that getting people elected today. But so it's clear that there were... it was a popular enough stance, or not an unpopular stance, that people, talked about it, disagreed about it. The Duke Bowers Law, it was actually repealed by the very next legislature, but they actually made a mistake in the repeal process, so it took another year to repeal it correctly.
Stacy, do you feel comfortable today in the current climate? We see a lot of political divisions, a lot of red state, blue state, and a lot of anger and frustration that has led to some incredible polarization of the American populace along political lines. Do you feel that? Do you sense that as you go about your work?
We really try to mitigate that as best we can, because we don't feel that this is an issue that either party has claim to. We are really trying to show that people across the spectrum, people who are fiscal conservatives, people who are pro-life, people who are very concerned about racial inequality and inequality for people who are poor. I mean, people all across what you might deem a conservative or a liberal or moderate even a position can get hooked into this issue for a variety of reasons. And so we try very much to talk to everybody across the board, because we believe that this is, and obviously innocence goes, to everyone. And so we really haven't, though that is clearly there, we very much try to not get caught up in that and play into that, but really say, look, this is an issue everybody needs to pay attention to for a whole variety of reasons.
Well, and actually it's very interesting. The chapter in Memphis has had an ongoing street vigil since 1999. Mm-hmm. They stand on the same street corner, except in lightning storms, every week, and they hold their anti-death penalty signs. And the folks who have been doing that now for more than 10 years, they said, at the beginning they got, lots of people yelling, out the windows at them, and people stopping and coming and arguing with them. But they said they've really noticed a change over time. Maybe it's getting used to seeing them there every week. But they said, more people, they get more thumbs up out the car window instead of folks yelling at them. They said their favorite sign is honk if you're opposed to the death penalty. So then they can imagine anyone honking, is on their side. But they have argued, it's just anecdotal, of course, but that the folks in Memphis driving by at rush hour at the corner of Union and McLean seem to be more accepting over 10 years' time of their stance than they were when they started.
There is a section or an essay in the book on mental illness and the death penalty, written by Dixie Gamble. Have people become more enlightened about when mentally ill or mentally retarded individuals commit murder or kill someone, about the necessity to look at that case in a different light?
It has, I believe, that has become somewhat better, but we've still got a long way to go there. I think the issue of people with mental retardation and intellectual disability, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled a few years back that it is not constitutional to execute those individuals. Tennessee has a fairly strict understanding of what that means, that may or may not be keeping up with sort of where the science community is on what that means, but it is there, and it is somewhat clearer to determine than what is severe and persistent mental illness, what constitutes it. So unfortunately, I think that in some instances, people with severe and persistent mental illness, it's recognized clearly and that the death penalty is not sought. But unfortunately, if your attorney is not doing their job, you know, if you're not able to really help with your defense, it is still happening that people with very severe mental illness, psychotic features, are being sent to death row.
Are the public defender's offices still overworked and underfunded?
Absolutely. We have a case, this is I think a telling case, of a man named Richard Taylor here in Tennessee. In 1981, Richard Taylor went to prison for, I believe it was stealing a car and joyriding. He had a history of mental illness, was on medications, antipsychotic medications, which somehow along the way he was taken off of while he was incarcerated. He became extremely psychotic and killed a correctional officer, which was a horrific tragedy. But the state chose to seek the death penalty for this individual. For the next 27 years, this case was litigated in the courts. 27 years. Finally, I believe it was in 2008, Richard Taylor was offered a deal to plead guilty and spend his life in prison. He accepted that after the state fought this and put this murder victim's family members through this and spent untold amounts of money to pursue death for somebody that for whom it should have never been on the table. And we know of several individuals that are sitting on death row right now who are as sick as Richard Taylor was. So this is a real issue, and I think the National Alliance on Mental Illness and other groups here in Tennessee are becoming more and more aware of this. And states like North Carolina and Indiana have been actually moving legislation to try to have people in that category treated the same as people with intellectual disability. So that, in other words, you can still be found guilty and you can still go to prison. You just can't be executed because it's these people are not should not be held to the same punishment as people who fully understand what they are doing.
With regard to the Judith Ann Neely case, a case with which you may or may not be familiar, and if you don't want to come in on a specific, you know, case, that's fine. But she and her husband Alvin were accused of murdering a girl and throwing her body into a canyon. Alvin was convicted in Georgia and got life. Judith was convicted in Alabama and got the death penalty. Mm-hmm. How can this be equal justice under law when there are different punishments for different co-defendants in different states for the same crime?
And it's even within the same state. It depends on the county. You know, in our state, we have 38% of death row comes from one county in Tennessee, and that's Shelby County. Some counties never seek it. So you could commit a crime in Shelby or in a different county and get very different sentences. The DAs, the district attorneys, have discretion as to whether they seek the death penalty. If a person meets one of 15 aggravators, I believe, is that right, Amy? One of 15 in the state, then the district attorney has the discretion to choose to seek the death penalty or not. So again, and in fact, we heard testimony. The legislature held hearings on the death penalty. A study committee was put together a few years back, and in those hearings, we heard the district attorneys talking about this and said, "Yeah, if you put 20 DAs in a room and give them a case, 10 of them will choose to seek the death penalty, and 10 of them won't." There's just that much
arbitrariness
still, you know. Given all the aggravating factors that we've tried to legislate in to try to make it more fair, it's simply still so much dependent on the sentiment of the community, on the particular way the DA is leaning, and whether or not they believe they can get the conviction and sentence.
Amy, as an historian, how did it feel for you to work on this book to combine your academic discipline with something that you feel very passionately about as a citizen?
was actually a great deal of fun. My first book, which was based on my doctoral dissertation, was an examination of the World Bank, the Food and Agriculture Organization, the World Health Organization. And after spending about 14 years of my life working on that, and it was all done, I had this wonderful thought that probably about 25 academics in the whole world would ever read this book. And as I started thinking about what I wanted to work on next, my involvement in the death penalty abolition movement here had initially prompted Harmon Ray, to whom this book is dedicated. Harmon, bless his heart, was a huge pack rat. And he had been involved in the death penalty abolition movement in Tennessee since 1975, and he kept everything.
Co-author of one of the entries in this book.
He is. On the history of the movement since 1975. And so I convinced him to donate, I think it was 45 boxes of papers related to the death penalty abolition movement to the Albert Gore Center here on campus. And it became the beginning of the Tennessee Death Penalty Archive. There are other collections of papers there. And I also noticed about the time I was doing this that Harmon's hair was getting a little white, and decided that I needed to do some oral histories with these folks to gather that information about this movement as well. And then as a historian, I'm like, okay, I have an archive, I have these oral histories, why not put this together? And in fact, I had been in Memphis doing oral histories and was staying with Margaret Vandiver, and I said, Margaret, what do you think about a book about this? And we sat down and sketched out the first draft of the table of contents at her kitchen table one day. But the really fun part about this book is how it's changed since that first dining room conversation. That first draft was pretty academic. It had the history parts, and then it had the thematic parts on mental illness, on judicial independence. So it was a pretty scholarly book. But then as we got thinking more about it, the third section of this book emerged, which we titled Rarely Heard Voices. In that section, we really wanted to hear voices of the people who were most directly affected by the death penalty in Tennessee. So in that section, that's the section where Stacy's piece is, reflecting on the execution of the man that she served as spiritual advisor to. That's where Hector Black's story is. Hector's daughter was brutally raped and murdered, and he and his wife travel around the state talking about why they oppose the death penalty. I did an oral history interview with Robert Glenn Coe's two sisters. Robert was the person who was executed in 2000, the first execution in Tennessee in 40 years, and what effect that had on them and on their family. And in a lot of ways, I think that part of the book may speak to people a little more than some of the earlier parts, sort of like Governor Clement going to death row, visiting with the men on death row, their families. That changed his heart on the issue. So the first two parts of the book might change people's mind about the death penalty. The third part might touch their heart.
And the part about Frank G. Clement, if I may get in a plug for one of our own, was the section called The New South's Abolitionist Governor, Frank G. Clement's Attempt to Abolish the Death Penalty, was written by Dr. Sekou Franklin of the MTSU Department of Political Science. I have to get in a plug for Sekou.
Absolutely.
The book is called Tennessee's New Abolitionist. I think it's safe to say that you will be able to find it at least in May from UT Press, co-edited by Dr. Amy L. Sayward and Dr. Margaret Vandiver. And Amy and Reverend Stacy Rector have been our guests today. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Jenna.
This is MTSU On the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. We invite you to join us again at this same time next Sunday. In the meantime, don't forget you can check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com. And we're available on iTunes.